Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Most important thing that I can share with you is that it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for inviting Sue and I to participate in our own recovery. We certainly participated in our own disease, so it's a privilege to be able to participate in recovery together, and I want to thank you all for making us feel at home and welcome, and our host and hostess, Ken and John, all the guys that have hauled us around, gals, and good to see my friend Grumpy come up, and I sponsored Grumpy a while, and good to see guys like that. I was wandering around back here, and a lady came up to me, and I didn't recognize her, but her husband was a guy named Iron Worker John, and he was there in the old Anaheim Club when I sobered up, and so there's people, you know, when you go out to these things, I may be from California, but there's people right here in this room that saw me when I was new. There was people, one of the ladies stood up with 20 years. What do you got, 20 years? Yeah. You know, they were there when I got there. So if you don't believe my story, they'll validate it. They'll tell you it was worse. And I'm grateful for that. I'm glad there's people that, you know, has always been there to see me and, you know, keeps me, you know, in tune with where I came from and what I am and what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm grateful for that. Thank you, son. Some people do anything to get on the stage, don't they? But I am you know, eternally grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for saving my life. And when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody that knows me is glad I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My neighbors are glad I'm in a meeting of AA. The cops are glad I'm in a meeting of AA. And my wife's glad I'm in AA. And my boss is glad I'm in AA. And most important thing about that is I'm glad I'm in AA. And there's been a lot of times whenever, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I didn't know who I was or where I was going, to tell you the truth. And it's a good feeling just to feel that, you know, you're an alcoholic. I'm just an alcoholic. And I'm glad of that. I check myself every time I sit down in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous all weekend. I sit down no matter who the speaker is or what's going on at this podium or any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I check myself 2 inches behind my belly button. And I check myself to see if I'm comfortable with being an alcoholic, be it just an alcoholic. And I'm grateful in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous it talks about a real alcoholic because I identify with a real alcoholic. I don't identify with a moderate drinker, a heavy drinker. I identify with a real alcoholic. I don't know if I crossed over some invisible line or not. If I did, I was loaded when I made the trip, and I don't remember. I come from a long line of alcoholics. That doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic. It isn't necessary to come from an alcoholic home in order to be an alcoholic. It helped. You know, it isn't necessary to lose wives, family, jobs, and cars to come to AA, but it helps if you've done that. And I've done all that. I lost everything. Matter of fact, even sold my soul in order to earn my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I give it my best shot. Everything I ever did, I give it my best shot. I'm just one of them kind of guys. I like the deal. I don't care what it is. You know, whether it's 50 cents or 50 million, deal me in. I like the deal. I want to be where the action is. Tonight, this is where the action is. You know, I don't know what them other people are doing over in Normal. That'd drive me crazy. If I had a choice like that every morning, am I in Bloomington or Bloomington Normal? Alcoholic has to make a decision every day, or they flounder all day long. You ever notice that? And I'm glad I'm just, you know, come to understand I drank myself right into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't identify with anybody specialized. If you specialize, there's stories in the big book for specialists. For beer drinkers and bourbon drinkers and champagne drinkers. I'm a pig myself. I'd do anything, anytime, anywhere. It didn't make any difference. I'd stick it in my ear if I thought I could get a fix off of it. Some of the people that I drank with said I did that too. I did it all. I don't like downers. I never like to be down. You miss things if you're down. And I never wanted to miss anything. I wanted to be there, whatever's going on. And You know, all my life I've been that way. I just like to be where the action is. I was a traveling kind of a drunk from the very beginning. I grew up in a small town in the Texas-Oklahoma Panhandle, farming community, wheat farmers. And I grew up in that farming community, and my daddy's a lawyer. And I've never resented the fact that my daddy's a lawyer. I've needed one all my life. Kept him on retainer for years. Turns out he's an alcoholic. Had to get a new lawyer when he couldn't get sober enough to show up for my court case, you know. And my grandpappy was a drunk, you know, and I come from a long line of drunks, and I don't know if I ever said I don't want to be a drunk, don't know if I ever said I want to be a drunk. I just did the next indicated thing, really, is what I did, and I grew up with guys that drank beer, drank that old 3-2 beer and peed a lot, you know, and just drink beer right around, drag main, got a pickup truck with a shotgun and rifle hacking the back window, stock racks on that thing, no horse, couple of ropes, you know, redneck tough. Kind of guys, you know, said, if you get in jail, we'll get you out, and if we can't get you out of hell, we'll get in there with you. You know what I mean? Just... Good old boy. Get drunk and be somebody, you know? Down there in Oklahoma, Texas, Oklahoma, where I grew up, well, they had white lightning, and they get in that fruit jar, man, and it looked like white gasoline. That thing's floating in it, you know what I mean? You take that and 3-2 beer, you know, and take a shot of white lightning and a shot of 3-2 beer, maybe a handful of Bennies, you know? Throw some Bennies in there on top of that. Man, it'd blow you right up against the wall. Bam! You go fall flat on your face and jump up. God, that's the best stuff I ever had in my life. Woo! Hell, it ain't even done nothing yet, you know. Can't get my breath. And, but I knew that it was going to happen. And I love that feeling. I love that feeling. I don't know if I was felt inadequate and immature and childish. And there was a guy who leaned up against the wall, waited for somebody to come along and pass me off a half a pint so we could have a party. I always brought the band, man. I brought the band. You want a party? Let's party. I'll tell you when it's over. You know? And I didn't drink with people that said, well, got to go home because I got to work tomorrow. I didn't identify with that. I had guys who say, well, I got to go home. I said, why? The old lady's going to be mad. I said, hell, mine's mad all the time. Don't make no difference. Why bother? You know? And I just went places and did things, and I had a good time with all that. And most of the time, occasionally we'd have a run of bad luck, but no big deal. I loved to have a good time, and I loved to go where the action was. And I did a lot of amphetamines when I was a young kid. While my uncle was a doctor, and he knew how to handle people that had those kinds of problems. He kept my Aunt Nina loaded for 50 years on phenobarbital, and I'd have just wandered around. And he said, well, you got a problem with this kid's got too much energy. And we should give him something. So he gave me amphetamines. That's speed. So I don't know why you would give somebody who has an abundance of energy speed. It's like going 190 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor, what it's like. Kind of get that pull back look, you know. There's no wind, but your hair just kind of pulls back. And run through rain and not get wet, you know. Little white things in the corners of your mouth occasionally that kind of give you away, and your teeth get flat. You carry on long conversations with no one about nothing. I got that down so good that I was a walking encyclopedia of worthless information, you know. Hell, I thought it was a book of knowledge, you know. I ran around with people that were like that, and I had an acquired taste for amphetamines by the time I was 9-10 years old. And, you know, I don't know when I, you know, really started my active drinking. I started my active drinking at 12, 13 years old. I lived in a farming community, and you could drive a car when you was 12 because they used the kids to drive the farm vehicles around, the wheat trucks, and used them to kids that have set on a pill. And I could get a farm permit when I was 12, and I had a car when I was 12, and I ran over my best friend in my car going to get a six-pack of beer on Friday, one Friday. And he was underneath the car, and I looked out, and I said, what the hell are you doing out there? You know, I mean, and I put the car in gear and took off and drove over him and broke his other leg, you know, because I had to get up there to get that beer. And later I got arrested that day, and they couldn't understand why it was that I didn't stop when I ran over that kid. And I didn't have the words to say, well, you see, this guy said he'd give me this beer, and it was... He's supposed to be there at 3 o'clock, and it was 10 till 3, and I didn't have the words to say. I didn't know what to say. I just knew that I had to get that beer. Once I got that beer, I didn't care what they did to me, you know. And you know, 30 years later, I'm standing in front of a judge and he's talking to me about doing things, and I didn't have any more of an answer then why I did that than I did 30 years before. I don't know why people always want to ask us stupid questions like that. Why do people want to ask an alcoholic a stupid question? Why did you do that? I don't know why I did it. If I had to think why I did it, I wouldn't want to did it. If you had to think very long about why you did it, you'd lose interest in it. And you'd have to think of something else you wanted to do. And then want to know about why did you do this when I'm trying to figure out why I did that. Because I've already thought about doing that and I felt just as guilty for thinking about doing it as I did for doing it. I never knew how to explain that. And it drove them crazy. Psychiatrists used to, the little vein in their forehead would just pulsate, you know. Well, they didn't ask me those questions because I didn't have those answers, you know. I didn't have answers for those things. And I don't say I was a frustrated child. I had some confusing questions being directed in my direction along the way. And by the time I was what would have been equivalent to being a sophomore junior in high school, why, they locked me up. Somebody wanted to study my behavior patterns. I think some psychiatrist had gone to school for a period of time and needed somebody to study. So they sent me to what was equivalent to a boys' reformatory school. It was a special school. It had a military-type environment. And I was in there with a bunch of kids just like me. And I remember the first week I was in there, why I went in this room and these guys had a paper bag and they filled it full of airplane glue and they were sticking their head in there. And I'm like, here, try this. And I didn't mind doing anything, but sticking my head in the bag was a little weird, especially with the guys that didn't know. And I remember thinking, I wonder if them little kids next door that go to Catholic school ever stuck their head in a bag with glue in it. But I went and stuck my head in there, you know, and got a pop off of it. And I learned how to, you know, cut them inhalers that was full of dexedrine, benzidine. We used to cut them, bash them inhalers and take that cotton out and cut the cotton and swallow the cotton that's full of benzedrine, pure benzedrine or dexedrine. And then you'd have to throw that cotton up right away or it'd constipate you for a month. So that cotton would swell up and you couldn't go to the bathroom for a long time. So you had to be very careful on your timing was important back then. And I learned how to do those things. I don't know why. Why would you want to stay up for 3 days if you're locked in a cell? Only an alcoholic would want to be locked up in a cell and would want to stay awake for 3 days to be sure they didn't miss nothing. You know what I mean? You know, somebody might give me a chance to escape. I'd be asleep and miss it, you know. And I never rationalized those kinds of things like that. And by the time I was 19, 20 years old, I had achieved some things in sports. I was doing a lot of things. I had been married and divorced by the time I was 19, 20 years old. You look at one side of me, like any alcoholic, you'd see certain things that I had achieved, certain things that I had done, good things. You look at the other side of it, and it's, you know, just totally different. It's a complete Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of a situation. By the time I was 19 years old, I was trying to turn my life around. I don't know what I was trying to turn around into, but I went back home. I always went home to recuperate. Alcoholics, like my type, always have to have a home. We have to have a nest to go back to recuperate, go back to mom or somebody, you know. And I went home and up in the Texas Panhandle, and I had just done 18 months down in South Texas to give me a little time to think. And I want to stay away from these guys that drink this wild white lightning. I'm going to stay away from these guys, have these pickup trucks with shotgun and rifle hanging in the back, and good old boys. I'm going to try them fast cars and stay away from them crazy women. And my very two best friends, Oily and Goose, met me at the train station. When I got off the train station, come up from Huntsville, and they had some white lightning and some 3-2 beer. And I got in a pickup truck, had a shotgun and rifle hanging in the back window, and I started telling Oily and Goose, you know, I got to stay away from guys like you. And they said, yeah, you should. You get in trouble, and so do we. And yeah, right. And I got to stay, you know, I got to get a job. I got to stay away from them crazy women. And they said, yeah, right. Stay away from them crazy women. We drove 2.5 hours drinking white lightning and 3-2 beer, and we pulled up in front of a little dance Saturday night, a place like this, big old barn-looking thing. Midnight, why, they had a band up there, you know, back then, Jerry Lee Lewis and all them, you know, Conway Twitty and all them cats would tour around out there and put on the dances, and we go in there, and the band was taking intermission going off there, and everybody was headed for the door, and I come through the door with Oily and Goose, and I didn't know what was happening. Everybody's taking a run. I didn't know if they was going to fiddle, whittle, or diddle. They were splitting, you know, intermission. And I walked in, a bunch of hairy-legged old boys leaning against the wall over there, and I grabbed a Coke bottle and rolled it down, bumped the dance floor, and I stood at the back of the room and said, "Let the mean son of a bitch in the house bring that back." It looked like a stampede coming my direction, is what it looked like. And all these crazy rednecks took a runner for me, and I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. I ain't going to stick around till that fight's over. So I punched the first guy leading the charge, and I split. And I went for the woman's restroom, which was right there by the door. I saw that when I came in. And there was a lady standing there, and I said, "Tell me when the fight's over." And I ran in the woman's restroom and hid. And a few minutes later, she stuck her head in and said, "You can come out now, cowboy." And a band started playing again, and I went out, and she was handy, and so I asked her to dance. I violated all the things that I said I wasn't going to do. I said I was going to stay away from them sick women, stay out of them fights, them honky-tonks, stay away from them guys. Just as soon as I got out of jail, there I go. Get right back with them guys, get right back in them places. And this gal was standing there, and I asked her to dance, and since I'm a quick study, one quick dance, I found out she had a job, a car, a place to stay, a driver's license, and I fell in love. Met all my requirements. And, you know, we had a quick, fast dance, and I said, "Where you been? I ain't seen you around in a while." And she said, "I've been in an unwed mother's home." I said, "Oh, well, I've been in the penitentiary. We deserve each other." "Hey, stick with me, baby. I'll take you places you've never been before." I did, too. Most of them, she didn't want to go, but hell, I took her anyway. You know how we are. And we took off a rip-roaring life of an alcoholic, and we skipped rope around there a little while, and, you know, she was just nuts, and, you know, we went honky-tonk and partying all the time. And just had a, you know, good old time. Our relationship was a little bit different than everybody else's. It seemed like we couldn't make love unless we beat the hell out of each other first, you know, to excite a little passion. I don't know. And it was just nuts. And, but it was the only thing I had going, what the hell. And 2 years later, she said, "You know, if you don't marry me, I'm going to kick you out." Well, hell, I still didn't have a car or a job or a place. You know, I mean, where am I going to go? "I'll marry you, you know, no problem." And sick women always want to give guys like me an ultimatum. "I don't know why you have to give us an ultimatum. We're not going to leave, you know. If you don't marry me, I'm going to kick you out." "I'll marry you, hell, no problem." I had no idea what marriage was. I didn't know what responsibility was. I found out later it's the ability to respond. I didn't know that. And, you know, we set out, got married, and she had a little girl, and I don't know anything about being a husband or father, and I didn't want to, you know, get rushed right into work. I never liked work. I'm a thief. I like to steal. I don't have much guilt either, except right when I get caught. And then it's very short-lived. Of course, you got to immediately think about what you're going to do to get out of trouble, of course. And that's the way I was. And I ended up with this woman and a kid. And you know, I accumulate things along the way. I accumulated a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me and a cat that hated me. And they sent me to the obedience class with the dog. "But take that dog down there and get him trained." I took that dog down to obedience class. That teacher out there had one of them weenie dogs, one of them long weenie dogs, had a long leash. Let that little weenie dog run way on that leash. He said, "Heel!" And he jerked that leash, and that little dog just went, my old German Shepherd attacking. He thought he was being cruel to that little weenie dog. Bit the instructor on the leg. The weenie dog started chasing me around, biting me, you know, and they kicked us out of the obedience class for being violent. You know, hell, I didn't do nothing. And I come home, you know, and the dog laid down in the living room. My daughter crawled over there and laid down on the dog. And my wife said, "You're home early." I said, "Well, we've been 86th out of the obedience class." And she says, "How come?" And I said, "They said we were violent." And I said, "Look at that dog. The kid's crawling all over that dog." And my wife said, "He's only violent when he's with you." You know, and that was true. And I didn't know. I mean, that's just the way things were, kind of. You know, I eventually had to leave Texas. As that happens, they call them trips around AA, call them geographics. When I left Texas, they call it an unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. I left in the middle of the night. Loaded everything up and went to the land of fruits and nuts. And it took us a month to get to California. And we got out there, and I had a drunken uncle help me get a house. And we moved into a house, got a hell of a deal on this house. Nobody lived in it in 2 years. A bunch of hippies lived on one side of me, and a motorcycle gang lived on the other side of me. And somebody dumped about 5 yards of gravel in the backyard, you know, and never done anything with it. Weeds going up through the gravel. Some windows in the house are broke, but I got a deal on it, and I like deals. If anything I can't turn down, it's a deal. I got a deal to move my wife and kids in there, and that middle of that, them hippies, I'd never seen nothing like that. down in Texas, them cats were dropping that LSD and wandering around the neighborhood, you know, with their clothes off, singing, humming songs. Occasionally they'd lay in the front yard and watch the sun come up and go down, you know. Very intellectual people. There was a guy over there named Doc and another guy named Professor, and I knew if I ever needed the answers to life, I could go see the Doc and Professor. They had all the answers to everything. I went over there one time and asked him, I'm having a little trouble with drinking. And they said, what's your name? And I said, Drum. D-R-U-M. And they said, oh, you must be Indian. Hey, I never thought of that. Yeah, Drum. Tom Tom. Yeah. That Indians should not drink fire water. They had the answer right away. I never knew that. So what am I going to do? I said, oh, you should smoke Thai sticks. Oh, right. What's Thai sticks? Oh, we'll show you. I said, what do you do when you smoke Thai sticks? Oh, we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I never wanted to wait for no ice cream truck. I always wanted to rob the ice cream truck. But I tried it anyway. Since I was an Indian, I needed a reservation. So I tried a little Thai sticks. I later tried some of that other stuff along the way, you know. First time I did LSD, I went to see 2001. And I just kind of did whatever was in front of me, whatever was free. I never turned down a free hit, you know. One time I went to see a rock concert and I strapped all this LSD on me and got out there and it was about 115 degrees outside and I started sweating and them hits started going off in a flash for 3 days, going right through into your skin. Take about 30 hits at once. Boom. You want to trip. And that's the way I did. I always overdosed on everything I did. I'm the kind of alcoholic can use a month's supply of anything up in a day. You know, just no problem. And, you know, that's the way it was. And I just, you know, but everybody around me was getting crazy. It wouldn't have really been a bad trip, but everybody around me was getting crazy. That was all my problem. The people around me were getting crazy. And the cops were coming to my house a lot. And I never called them. I didn't want them. I never once said, I think I'll go call the cops and have them come arrest me. I feel like going to jail. I'd get out there and, you know, just have a little fun, you know, shooting the fireworks up on Christmas Eve that I didn't get to shoot up on the 4th of July because I was in jail. You know, they frowned on that. I'd bring all my friends home with me, you know, and they'd all lay around in there and go wild. And my wife would go crazy. Run around the house. She started carrying a butcher knife around all the time, stabbing people unexpectedly, you know. I'd always bring my friends home with me, and she'd meet me at the door with a butcher knife, waving that knife around, talking all the time, waving. I like guns myself. I'd stick my gun right on her nose. I like to slap her upside the ear and run off a round off my .44 mag. Bam! They'll pay attention when you do that. They won't hear nothing, but they'll pay attention to you. She stick that knife right in my face, and my buddies behind me say, get her, get her. I said, hell, you get her. She's got a knife. I went to sleep one time 15 minutes into a conversation with a non-alcoholic. Don't ever do that. They don't like rejection. And I passed out 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. She was giving me the what fors. And I passed out, and she stabbed me all over my back with that knife, just all over my back. A few hours later, I came to. God! Damn, something's the matter with my back. And she said, oh, let me look. I said, oh, you broke out of acne of the back. You've been drinking that old rot gut whiskey. You broke out of acne of the back. You need some rubbing alcohol on you. Yeah. I'm going to tell you, I come from down in Texas where them Baptists, they dip me, sprinkle me. They give me every kind of a baptismal you ever get, but that alcohol bath got me closer to Jesus than anything I ever did, I'll tell you. And you only do that once. For 10 years or more, me and my wife, anytime we slept together in the bed, I kept a loaded .45 with a hammer back around in the chamber and a safety off on the nightstand. She slept with a butcher knife sticking out between the mattresses. The handle sticking out, or it was under the pillow. We loved each other a lot. Those weapons were not to protect us from somebody outside of the house. And there has to be a God, you know. There has to be. And, you know, it progressively got worse, and I got in a lot of trouble. I got in a lot of physical violence in our life. Just a lot of physical violence. A lot of people don't understand that. You don't understand that physical violence. If you go back out and drink, and you may get to understand it. And, our daughter suffered a lot from that. Our daughter ended up being, you know, just one of them kind of, she withdrew, and she looked like a wounded animal, like a little rat running around back scurrying around in that household. And, I think there was some point where we moved right on beyond shame, and we lived in some gray zone where, you know, it just, there were no feelings. There were no feelings. There was about a year and a half of my drinking. I went to AA, and I didn't stay sober, and for 4 years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last year and a half of my drinking, I would go to AA meetings and just sit in there. I didn't identify with anybody. I didn't try to do anything. There's nothing worse than being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not really an alcoholic. Really, really. And I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just, you know, I didn't identify. I didn't want to look around there and say where people normally wouldn't mix, and I wouldn't have drank with most of the people in those meetings I was going to, much less sell them dope, you know. And so I just, you know, was just hanging around there. And I didn't stay sober. And May the 10th, 1976, we had reached a point where we could not go any farther. And our whole family had, and I had. And I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time, really. And I had nobody. And I was in a lot of trouble, and that didn't make any difference. My family hated me, and that didn't make any difference. It hadn't been working for a long time, and that didn't make any difference. I'd done all kinds of things, good and bad, and that didn't make any difference. And I ended up on my living room or bedroom floor crawling around in my house the last few days of my sobriety, or drunkenness there, and lip-dragging drunk, you know, crawling across that old linoleum. You know, gurgling, talking, you know. And ain't nobody there saying, hey, Ace, tell me another one of them racy stories about where you've been, what you did. Ain't nobody there. Gurgling. Big time Charlie, crawling around in there gurgling. Tried to commit suicide and couldn't kill myself. Needing that drink, crawling around in there trying to remember where you put that last drink somewhere in there, you know, just the insanity of that. And the whole family had suffered beyond anything that anybody could imagine, really, in our wildest drunken dream. We've gone to that point. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. When an alcoholic's ready to sober up, nothing can keep him from sobering up either. If an alcoholic don't want to sober up, ain't nobody can make him sober up. But if an alcoholic wants to sober up, look out. We'll sober up in spite of you. We'll sober up because of you. We'll sober up in spite of everybody. A little gray-headed man came over to my house, did a 12-step call on me, and I ain't had a drink since. And against all odds, I have stayed sober against all odds. You remember, at the Anaheim Club, everybody said, them guys are crazy. Stay away from them. Me and our iron worker John and them guys, Ron, Rotten Ron, we had a special meeting for the crazies. It was a men's stag, Friday night men's stag. They call it the chicken fuckers meeting. I know you ain't supposed to say that, but that was the name of the meeting. And everybody was glad we didn't go to the other meeting. They talked our native tongue in there. Profanity. And it was sick, full of sick guys, sick, crazy guys. I used to sit in there and I'd take my gun into that meeting. And I'd sit in that meeting and these guys would talk about all this sick stuff. And I knew they needed to die. So I'd take my gun out of my boot at a .44 mag, sawed off. Take my gun out of my boot, take a bullet out of my gun, and write their name while they're sharing right on that bullet. I'm going to kill you right after the meeting. And I'd take that bullet and put it back in there, and somebody else would talk about something sick, sick stuff. And, sickest stuff you ever heard in your life. And I'd think, well, I forgot who I was going to kill as soon as the meeting was over. And they'd have the end of the meeting, and they'd all stand up and hold hands, put their arms around each other, and they'd pray. And I think next week I'll come back and throw a grenade in here and kill them all. And them guys just loved me. They loved me. I was just so crazy. I was not somebody that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and just fell right into your arm. I was crazy. When you took that stuff away, I was crazy. I couldn't sit in one place. I just had all this energy and it wasn't going anywhere. And I couldn't beat on anybody anymore. They told me that there's things that I not only couldn't drink or use, I couldn't run. And they told me not only could I not drink or use a run, I couldn't hit my wife and kids anymore, anybody else. And they told me not only could I not drink or run or not hit my wife and my kid anymore, I couldn't cheat on my wife anymore. And you know what? That leaves you with a lot of energy. You sit in meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, with a lot of energy and no place to go. I used to get up on Saturday mornings, with my favorite mornings. I had to get down to the old Anaheim Alano Club, man. I had to get down there, and they'd have early morning meetings, Saturday mornings. Saturday mornings were just crazy for me, and Sue was going to Al-Anon and had an Al-Anon sponsor, and she'd run in there and call her sponsor and get on that phone. And Saturday morning, I think, I got to get to that meeting. The meeting's at 9 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock, I'm thinking about it. I got to get to that meeting, you know? And I go in and think, well, I'm from Texas. So I'd go put on my Levi's and my boots and my big belt buckle and a cowboy hat, my vest, and I'd get in front of mirror, and I'd do a couple of shit howdies, and I'd get my pickup truck out there, and I'd go out and kiss her goodbye. She'd be talking to her sponsor, and I'd get my pickup truck, and I'd drive down the street a couple of three blocks, and I'd hit a red light, and I'd think, no, I'm not a cowboy today. I'd turn my pickup around, and I'd drive back home, pull it up in the driveway, and I'd go in, and I'd think, I'm a biker. And I'd go in and take off my cowboy stuff, and I'd put on my leathers and my bandana, and I'd get in front of the mirror, and I'd do a couple of rev-ups, and they'd ride my Harley down there to that meeting and drive it right up them old-timers' ear. And I'd get in front of that mirror and get all pumped up and go out and kiss her goodbye and go out and fire my Harley up and drive it around the neighborhood, piss all the neighbors off, and roar down towards the meeting hall and hit a red light. And I'd look at myself in that mirror, and I'd think, no, I'm kind of a marshmallow today. And so I'd whip the Harley around and go back and park it in the house. And I'd go in and I'd think, well, maybe I'll whip some of them $75 words on them cats down at the meeting. So I go get the dictionary out and I take my leathers off, put on my three-piece suit that my sponsor got for me and my tie and everything. And my wife would be out there talking to her sponsor, you know. I'd get that dictionary out and I'd look up some of them $75 words and I'd recite some of them big words so I could impress all the old-timers when I got down there. I'd go out and kiss her goodbye, go out and give them a big Lincoln and take off down the street and I'd hit a light down there and I'd forget all them big words I was going to impress them people in the AA with, you know. So I'd have to turn that Lincoln around, go back and run in, take off my three-piece suit, put on my sweats, run out and kiss her goodbye and jog to a meeting. You ever wonder why a newcomer's tired when they get to a meeting? They've had three or four identity crises. Man, if you can get it down to four, you're in, you know, you're ahead of the game, you know. My wife's sponsor says, yeah. But ain't that fun, huh? Ain't that fun? Jesus, you got to have a whole personality change in each one of those things. Got to do a fifth step each time you got one of them costumes on. And they said, when you're here, hurry up and do a fifth step. Well, do I do it as a cowboy? Do I do it as a biker? Do I do it as a lawyer? Or do I do it as a jogger? I'm just about to run the Boston Marathon. I think I'll do a fifth step. And geez, I didn't know who it was or where it was going. I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest or walking or riding a bicycle, for Christ's sake. You want me to do a fifth step? And one time my wife's sponsor said, how many people live in that house? That's so crazy I could have posed for a family portrait by myself, you know? I hear people say, I wondered what I was going to do with all my time when I sobered up. They didn't have a problem like me, I'll guarantee. I was so busy changing costumes, I didn't have time to think. You know, and you know, I was just crazy. My sponsor take me on these fifth steps or these 12 steps all the time with all these crazy people. Man, we go on these 12 steps. He'd load up this old van full of all a bunch of newcomers. We'd go out to go on a 12 step. And we'd get some goofy guy and throw him in there and haul him around to all the meetings, you know. And, you know, I tried to work that step. I tried to work a fifth step, fourth and fifth step. I did a first one, I did an autobiography from age 0 to age 12. If you really want to get into some deep thinking, try to figure out how you felt when you came out of the womb. That's good for a Saturday afternoon, you know. My father said, I'm going crazy. I can't figure out how I felt when I came out of the womb. I don't know if I was an alcoholic when I came out of the womb. And he said, here, why don't you do it this way? And he had me a matchbook cover and a little pencil. And he said, here, do your fourth step on this. I said, it's a matchbook cover. He said, I know. You're a real simple person. Just put, I'm a liar. Start with that. I'm a cheat and a thief. You know, and they always simplified those things. I said, I have trouble with this God thing. It's driving me crazy. I'm a Southern Baptist, Southern Baptist. I'm a Buzzard Baptist. The only time I ever went to church is whenever there was something dead or something to eat. A funeral. And I didn't know. I didn't know. My sponsor said, we're going to simplify real, eat real quick. He said, all you need to know about God is there is one, and you're not him. Took a big load off my shoulders, to tell you the truth. And I didn't know. You know, I just ride around with my sponsor. I'd take my gun out of my boot, and I'd be playing with it. I couldn't even intimidate my sponsor. He was too crazy. He was too into himself. You ever have a sponsor that's so into themselves they don't even understand what you're doing? We'd pull up to the stoplight. I'd take my .44 mag out, and I'd stick it in my mouth. And I'd pull a hammer back just enough to spin the cylinder. And he's sitting there at the light, and he don't even notice it. And I said, you got to talk to me about God. I got to know about God. I'm not going to make it if you don't teach me about God. And he'd look across the street over there at the light, and there'd be some goof standing at the light. And he'd say, see that guy over there? And I said, yeah. He said, you want to kill him? I said, hell, I don't even know him. He said, I know. Do you want to kill him? And I said, I don't even know him. Do you want to kill him? No. For you, that's spiritual. But, hey, when I got here, I had a philosophy in life. Make an enemy a day. If you don't make an enemy, and I ain't talking about just a little piss off. I'm talking about make somebody mad each day enough that they think about you for at least a month. I mean, that's taking hostages, baby. And, you know, and I come to AA, and, you know, he's saying, love is the answer. I had no concept of love. I had no idea. Fear was my partner. Fear was my partner all my life. And here I sober up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got all these negative emotions and all these crazy ideas, and I'm trying to work these steps. God, I am so glad that God didn't let me see me all at once. Gee, money, I couldn't have handled it. I wouldn't have made it if I'd have seen me all at once. Gradually, I got to see me. Gradually. My wife's going to all these Al-Anon meetings, and she's kids going to Al-Ateen, and the dog's going to Al-Dog, and the cat's going to Al-Cat. You know, it released me right off. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. I really didn't know what I had no concept of what was going on. And I owed money. I owed money to people. I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd say, we got these financial amends, and I'm crazy. I owe money to people that you can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. They're going to blow a hole in my hands. They don't get their money back soon. And they're calling my house, and they're going to break my kid's leg if they don't get their money back soon. And it drove me crazy. I didn't know what to do, you know. And my sponsor didn't come over and say, how much you need, kid? I'll write you a check. My sponsor said, those are things you're going to have to figure out. And my wife went to Al-Anon, and she never, ever deprived me of the privilege of paying my own debts. She always let me stand alone. Jesus, thanks a lot, you know. And I had no idea how I was going to do these things. I owed all this money. I went and borrowed a bunch of money. I went and lied to a banker that I grew up with and borrowed a bunch of money from him. I paid off my debts, you know, with hot money and all that kind of stuff. Oh, it's crazy. I didn't just run out and say, oh, gee, let me go down and get a conventional loan. I owed Aetna Finance $10,000, and it wasn't even my signature. And it was her Social Security number on there, you know. And it was my father's, you know, reference. I had everybody covered, you know. And I had all these people gunning for me, and I sobered up. I mean, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They wondered why I'd start out in a chair over here, and when the meeting's over, I'd scooted that chair around about 40 times. I'd be clear out there, you know, just nuts. And I'd come home, and I'd lay in bed and just think, and I'd have them drunk dreams, and I'd just shoot up out of that bed just crazy, and I'd sweat and scream in the middle of the night, just shoot up in the middle. And, my wife just, she went to Al-Anon, and God bless Al-Anon. My daughter went to Al-Ateen, and God bless Al-Ateen, because they allowed me to go through that. They allowed me to kick it. When I come out of that detox, you know, there's one thing that's been very apparent along the way. People have gone through treatment centers here. When I went through a treatment center, there was 39 of us went through the treatment. The last day at that treatment, they put us in a circle. God has a funny thing. He started on my left, and he went around there, and everybody in that room got to take each other's inventory. And 38 people said I was going to drink or get loaded as soon as I hit the street. And they were so convincing that I thought, you know, almost voted against me. And there was a little fire inside of me that said, heck with you, dude. I'm going to make it. And I'm the only one out of 39 that had. See? So this ain't a popularity contest, and I don't care how the vote goes. You know, I'm the only one that has made it out of those 39. And there's better guys than me than gals that were in that 39. It isn't the popularity count that make any difference. I just wanted to stay sober. There was a fire 2 inches behind my belly button. I said, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. I'm going to gut it through it. And, you know, you can do that. You can white-knuckle sobriety. I mean, I stayed sober the first year and a half of my sobriety on a resentment. So don't let anybody say you can't. I'm living proof that hate will keep you sober. It'll kill you physically. Yeah, but you won't drink. You'll go down to the end. And three and a half years sober, I'm laying in hospital, and I'm bleeding out of every opening of my body because of hate. I'm not going to drink. You know, the book says insanity or death. And at 3.5 years sober, I'm just crazy. I've worked the steps. I don't feel any better. I'm paying this amends back. I don't feel it. I did not go and pay money back for things that I no longer have and have an overwhelming good feeling that I'd done the right thing. It didn't make me feel good. Made me feel bad. I don't like to give money away to people. I like to keep it and enjoy it. And I didn't feel good because I did that. I didn't feel good because I did a fifth step because I was nuts and I wasn't honest about a lot of that stuff. They say, do a fearless moral inventory. I had no morals when I sobered up. Yeah. The curse of a thief is that he can't trust himself. You know, I'm going to trust somebody to tell my stuff to him. I had things that if I'd have told people about and they had told anybody else, we'd have both done time. You know, and them for withholding information. You know. And I had all that crap going on, and I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I worked the steps the best of my ability, and I'm standing around there, I'm just nuts, I'm crazy, my wife's going to Al-Anon, she's running around wallpapering the house everywhere, you know. Now, 3 years sober, I'm so dry, I'm a fire hazard. I could quote the book, I could tell you what page is on. You see them around here all the time, they're all over AA. Come up. I'm crazy, I'm going to drink. Well, son, just pray. You ever want to take one of them guys disco? Disappears. Yeah. Well, what step are you on, kid? Jesus, I just want to take the big book and tear it in little pieces and feed it to him. I sat down next to the guy and I just had all this crazy stuff going on and I didn't understand what the hell was going on. I sat down next to him in a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, you've been here how long? He said, 29 years. How old are you? 78 years old. I said, well, 29 years of sobriety, 78 years old. You must not be afraid to die. He said, no, my house is in order. I whipped my .44 out and stuck it under his chin. I said, if you're not afraid to die, why are you sweating? You know what that old fool did? He took my gun away from me in that AA meeting, took it out and put it in my car. And told me that I'm welcome in AA, but my gun's not. Can you imagine that? He was sober long enough I couldn't intimidate him. Blew me away. See? Blew me away. I couldn't intimidate those people. They wouldn't put up with my crap. And when by the time I was 3.5 years sober, I was just insane. I didn't know I was ready to die. And I was standing around a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, standing in the corner. My sponsor made me stand in one corner, and he didn't stand by me. He stood in the other end. And he'd wave at me over there, you know, and a newcomer would come in the room, he'd snatch him and pull him over, you know, and he'd point at me over there. You know you're the sickest one of your group if your sponsor of the old timers gets the newcomer to kind of stand there and point at you over there. I asked one of them newcomers one time, I said, what did my sponsor say about me? He said, your sponsor said that if I go back out and drink, I could end up like you. That you're as good as you're ever going to be. And I didn't know what to do. I was standing there one day. I had trying to do everything. You know, I said, clean up, show up, shape up. I went down. My sponsor got me this suit. One of them three-piece suits, pinstripes, green tie, green underwear. He told me, wear underwear now. You're sober. And get the colored underwear so you can wear them 3 days, turn them inside out, and wear them 3 days. You get 6 days out of them, baby. That way you won't have to miss a meeting. Hey, no time for laundry. Do laundry on Saturday and Sunday. So you have to get underwear. You can get 6 days out. And it made sense to me. And, you know, got this deal. And I got me a big Mark IV Lincoln. My sponsor He sponsored a used car salesman, and this guy set me up a hell of a deal on his Lincoln, big Mark IV Lincoln. And I get my three-piece suit on, and I get my Lincoln, drive it down, and park it in front of the meeting hall, give the newcomers hope. You know, hey, you know, you got nothing else. The book says you can't give something what you ain't got, and all I had was the dressing, you know, the window dressing. I'd park my big Lincoln out there, and I'd put on my three-piece suit, and I'd stand in there and radiate hate. And I just hate it. I just, like, battery acid. You want to work the steps, kid? Huh? I was dying. I was dying. I was so sober, I was just dying. You know, I mean, there ain't nothing worse than having it and not knowing what the hell to do with it. You know, I mean, and I stand in there one day, and I just knew that, you know, I wasn't going to drink. I was just going to die. Crawl off someplace and die if I didn't implode first. This is crazy. And I looked around, and this weirdo standing next to me, the weirdest looking guy I ever seen. Man, he wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. Just weird. Had hair sticking out everywhere. Had a little welder's cap on with strawberries and cherries on, you know, pulled down over one ear like they do, you know. And he was the treasurer of the meeting that had been in the night before, and they asked for a treasurer's report, and he stood up and said, "I stole all the money, and I ain't paying it back." I said, "Why don't you comb your hair?" And he said, "I did." I said, "Hell, you did." Everywhere. He's giving himself a permanent, you know, and just, yeah. I said, "What do you want?" He said, "Will you be my sponsor?" Oh, shit. God, man, I was waiting on a lawyer, a doctor, a parole officer, or a cop to come in and ask me to be their sponsor. You know, oh, man, I can't even take care of my own stuff. How can I take care of his, you know? And I said, "I'll go ask my sponsor." I went across the room and said, "See that weirdo over there?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, he asked me to be his sponsor." My sponsor said, "Yeah, I know. I sent him over there." I hated my sponsor. I hated him. I didn't have the words to explain how much I hated my sponsor. But I didn't argue with him. He said, "You go over there and tell that guy you'll be his sponsor and you do exactly what he says." That don't make sense to me today. Why would I go tell this goofball that I'm going to be his sponsor and I'm going to do exactly what he says? Them old timers are crazy, you know. They tell you to do shit, and if it works, they try it. I know. And, I went over to that guy that said, "My sponsor says, I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do?" And he says, "I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln." Yeah, okay. "Hey, you go out that door, and I'll go out this door, and I'll meet you at the big Lincoln." And he grabbed me by the arm and said, "No, I want to be with you." And we took off for the door, man. We get over by the door, and two guys I know leaning against the door jamb, and this weirdo says, "That's my sponsor!" I said, "Man, don't tell people I'm your sponsor, for Christ's sake. I don't want nobody to know I'm your sponsor." Them guys looked at us and said, "Boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow." I got that weird on that Lincoln, and I'd take him to meetings. He'd talk 666 stuff to me. And then he'd say, "You ever do anything like that?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I did some stuff like that." And I'd start telling some of my sick stuff, you know, stuff I was never going to tell anybody. And matter of fact, a couple of things came up I forgot to tell my sponsor, and I kind of just dropped it on him. You know, what the, he never noticed it. One time he went to pick him up the next day, and he said, "I know some of that stuff you told me last night was a lie." "How do you know that?" And he said, "Because I went home and tried to do it, and it's physically impossible to do." Well, you got to be from Texas and grow up on a farm. He's a city boy. I didn't know what was going on. You know, I didn't have any idea. He wanted to talk about God. He wanted to take a third step. I said, "What do you want to do? What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, we got to have a spiritual experience, man. We got to have a spiritual experience." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Like a burning bush or parting of the water." I think if I had some lighter fluid, I could torch the hedge over here or something. I don't know. I had a .45 in my glove box. I pulled it open, run around in the chamber, stuck it up beside his head, pushed real hard, and I said, "I'm going to count to 10. If this gun don't go off, believe in God." I counted to 10, laid the hammer down, threw it back in the glove box. He jumped out of my leg and run around that sucker 3 or 4 times, run over back in that meeting where my sponsor was, dropped a dime on me, told my sponsor, showed him that little ring on the side of his head where I had to barrel that .45, and told my sponsor I stuck a .45 inside of his head and made him do a third step. My sponsor said, "Yeah, I know, ain't he spiritual?" I know that sounds crazy, but me and him are both still sober. You know, that's all I've been doing. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it is. Don't look for something that's not here. And I've been doing that ever since. An amazing thing. I worked the steps to the best of my ability, and at some point in my life, working the steps with me was no longer getting it. And because I had the old-timers in my life that said, you know, now, give it away, and they sent somebody in my direction, and I started helping another alcoholic, and my life has changed. And I've been working with them alcoholics, I've been working with them drunks every day from that day to this. And my life has changed. It's gone my wildest drunken dream. My wife and I have been together 33 years, and we have a good relationship, and I love her very much, and she loves me. My house is in order. I've got a job. I had to go to work at 46 years old and 10 years sober. I had to get a job. Didn't want to rush into anything, but eventually had to happen. And, you know, and my daughter come out of that hellhole, my daughter and I have a very good relationship. And she's forgiven me for the things that I've done, and I've forgiven me for the things I've done. And my life is full of drunks, and I love drunks, and that's my whole life is around. I work with a lot of young people in my home group area. My home group's a dog on the roof, Men's Stag. This is the year that meeting's 32 years old. It started out an old man, an old drunk machinist. His wife kicked him out of the house, and he moved a little shed out behind his house, and he started building onto it and made a room there where he could live, kind of a little apartment type thing back on the alley. And by the time he got it done, he sobered up, and she let him back in the house. And when he's working on that thing back there, he used a big tree right in the middle of the yard, and he used to put the ladder up on the tree, and his dog had a couple of old dogs, and the dog would run up the ladder and get on top of the house. And then to drive her crazy, he put a ladder over the garage and a ladder over the house, so the dog would run from the meeting hall over to the garage over to the house to drive his wife crazy. And he sobered up, and they started having meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in a room back there, and they called it the dog on the roof, because every Thursday night, while they'd put this ladder up there, and the dog would get up on the roof, and they'd bring all these newcomers over there to this meeting, and they'd put them in there in the middle of the meeting, and the dog would run all up over the roof, and them newcomers, they'd say, that's God up there. Yeah. That meeting's 32 years old, and I'm now the old-timer of that group, and there's about 80 young guys there, and there's kids there that sobered up when they're 16, 17 years old. Kids, L.A. kids, off the street, street kids, came there, and several of them now have over 10 years of sobriety. You know, there's 8 or 9 kids there that sobered up 16 years old and have over 10 years of sobriety. You know, good members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my home group, and they love me, and I love them. And I've been all over in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there ain't no group like my home group. I love them. I've looked for that. I looked for what I had in my home group a lot of different places, trying to find it, and I had to come back to my home group to find out that that's where it is. That's my meat and potatoes. That's the people that know me and the people that love me. In 80 guys, there's 80 guys in that meeting. There's 7 generations of sponsorship. I don't sponsor all the people in my home group. They sponsor guys. There's guys in there who sponsor guys who sponsor guys. And it's a good group. And Sue has an Al-Anon group that's her home group, got a one Al-Anon group, and there's about 30, 40, 50 gals, and they're young gals in there that, come off the street type of gals, and bit fenders, you know, all the ones that are a little lame, we get them over at our group, you know, and I love my home group, and I love the people there, and I'm a very active member in that, and I go to a speaker meeting on Monday night and Tuesday night, and I go to a meeting on Wednesday night. I go into the penitentiary. I love going into penitentiaries. I love going into penitentiaries. I like to go into penitentiaries because it's for fun and for free. There's nothing more gratifying than to go into a jail or a penitentiary because it's totally for fun and for free. There's not a lot of applause or hoopla or anything. Sue and I are very active in the penitentiary system. We both go in these things. I remember the first time I went into penitentiary, I went into San Quentin Penitentiary, a big penitentiary in California, and I went in there and sat down, and there was this unbelievable feeling of gratitude for the freedom that I have today, the freedom. You know, not only for my sobriety to be able to get up this morning and be behind the door that I had the key to be able to walk out there in the sunlight of the Spirit today, and a lot of times we take these kind of things for granted, I love those kind of things because it's those things that I do during the week that give me the strength to come here and be with you, to take the trip, to be able to come from California here and get here when I said I would. be able to be here with you all weekend, walk around outside out there, walk around in here, just be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not some kind of a speaker. I'm just a drunk. I'm not anything special. I'm just a drunk. And I'm willing to do anything to stay sober. And when I go back home and I go to those penitentiaries during the week and go into those kinds of meetings, it gives me the gratitude and the humility to understand that I'm just doing God's work. And God sends me where He wants to. Because I came here and I said, I'll do anything. And this life has given me the ability to walk out there on the sunny side of the street and hold my head up. And I haven't had to crawl before anyone. I haven't had to look down on anybody. I don't want to miss nothing. I want to be a part of everything. You know, when I was a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard a guy tell a story about a little boy who lived on a farm. I love that story because it describes Alcoholics Anonymous. A little boy standing out there with his daddy one day on that farm. And a big guy come whipping down the road in a big black Buick. Beautiful big Buick, big shiny car. And he come whipping down the road and whipped right up in there on the front of that farmhouse. And the little boy standing there watching his dad. The old man went out and did a little, you know, transacting with this guy. And the guy whipped that Buick down there by the barn. And the barn, side of that barn was right by a farm-to-market road. Where everybody that lived in the farming community went to town. They had to go down that road. And the little boy watched this deal, and that old boy whipped the back of that Buick open down there by that barn and started getting these rolls of paper out and some stuff, and he started putting this poster up on the side of that barn. And the little boy stood there and watched it. He'd never seen anything like that in his entire life. And what evolved on the side of that barn was a picture. Maybe some of you have seen it. It used to be Barnum Bailey Circus used to come along, and they'd put those big old posters on the side of a barn or on the side of a building or warehouse or something so that everybody went to town would see that big old poster of all the beautiful animals and the beautiful people in that circuit. The little boy had never seen anything like that. He lived on that farm all his life, and he'd never seen anything like that. He'd never seen animals like that. He'd never seen people with costumes like that. And the little boy watched that, and he went back up and he asked his daddy. He said, Daddy, what is that? And being a good father, the father said, Son, that's a circus, and it'll be in town in a few weeks. And if you're a good boy and work real hard, when the circus comes to town, I'll let you go. The little boy worked all week, and he'd go down there every opportunity he could, and he'd look at that poster on the side of the barn. He'd try to visualize what those animals were like in living color and what those people would be like, what it'd be like to see it come the day of the circus. In the olden days, while the circus would come into the town on a train, and they'd go down to one end of the town and they put up a big top down there, a big tent, huge big tent down there in the fairground. And on the day of the opening day of the circus, while they'd bring all the animals off the train and all the people and the performers would put on their costume, their beautiful costumes, the sequins and the beautiful people. And they'd get on the elephants and they'd have the tiger cages and they'd make a parade right down through the center of town. And that day that little boy went to town, as he come to the edge of town, while there they were coming off the train. All the beautiful people and all their beautiful costumes and all the animals. And he sat right down there on the curb on Main Street. And he watched them make a curve right down through the center of town, ease on down to the other end of the town. He had no idea that there was a big top down there. He sat there and he watched the parade, and the last person in the parade was a clown. When the clown went by, he tipped his hat to the little boy, and the little boy, being unknown of what was going on, he thought that was the end of the deal. He took a 50-cent piece out of his pocket that his father had given him, and he flipped it up into the clown's hat, and the clown caught it, stuck it on his head, and went on down the street and went into the big top. Little boy got up and he walked all the way back home, 5 miles back home. And when he got home, his dad said, Son, did you see the circus? And the little boy said, Yeah, Daddy, I saw the circus. But he didn't, you see. He just saw the passing parade. That's a sad story. It's a very sad story. A very sad story. See, because he didn't get in the big top. He didn't get nothing but the passing parade. I don't want to be a sad story. I don't want to be a sad story. I've been a sad story all my life. Came here to Alcoholics Anonymous and you showed me. You gave me the tools. You gave me the steps. You gave me a sponsor that's a tool in my program. You gave me a home meeting. You gave me people. You gave me choices. You gave me examples, good and bad. And I said in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, on occasion I get so angry and all that anger had built up inside of me, and I'd just be so eat up with it and so jealous and so eat up with resentments and all those kinds of things. I stayed here anyway, in spite of it. I learned a very great, great lesson. I want to share it with you, and then I want to shut up. My home group, like I told you, is a men's stag. Some 3.5 years ago, a young man walked into a meeting where I was at. His name was Scott. Beautiful young guy. I'd known him for 9 years. For 9 years, every time I went to meetings of alcoholics around the place, well, Scotty would show up. And he'd come up to me and he'd say, "Hey, I want to stay sober." And he just couldn't stay sober. Couldn't make it. And for 5 years, in and out, in and out, in and out. I'd go to meetings and I'd go to talk, or I'd go to be there with somebody and Scotty'd be there. He might have a day sober, he might have a week sober, he might have a year sober. He didn't know. And I'd always put my arms around him and I'd say, "You can make it, you can make it. If I can make it, you can make it." And I'd give him my best shot. 4 years ago, I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and Scotty's standing. And he come up and he put his arms around me and he's crying. Now, I don't know if I could tell him, maybe he'd hit a bottom. I don't know how you know if anybody's hit a bottom, but I give him the same old shot I always gave him before. "You can make it. Come on, you can make it." And he looked me right in the eyes and he said, "I believe I can make it. I believe I can make it this time." And he said, "Will you be my sponsor?" And I said, "Sure. Sure, man." And we started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took Scotty to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every night. When I couldn't take him to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, some guy's sponsor took him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the kid loved Alcoholics Anonymous with all his life. He lit up with Alcoholics Anonymous. He lit up and I could not believe it. I mean, this kid, you can imagine, with having 5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had all kinds of problems when he sobered up. He did not just come here. But his problems didn't bother him, man. He'd go up to newcomers. I'd tell him to work the steps. He'd work a step and then he'd go find a newcomer and he'd just light up about the step, man. He'd go find some newcomer and he'd talk to him about the step. "Man, I just worked this step. You got to see how I worked this step." And he was a buffed out kind of a kid, a roofer, you know, one of the construction guys. And he just had all the enthusiasm about life. And I'd look at him and I'd think, "Jesus, man, don't you ever have a bad day?" And then the next day he'd get up and on his way to work, he'd drive into somebody in his car, you know, and he'd call me up and he'd be crazy, he just had a wreck, you know. I'd say, "Oh man, it'll work out." And he'd try to, you know, set the deal up and get the old fender pried out so he could go to work. And I'd see him in a meeting that night, and man, he'd come and he'd put his arms around me and he'd hug me and he'd say, "Man, I had the worst day of my entire life, man, but I'm so glad to be in Alcoholics Anonymous." He was lit up with it, and I'd look at that guy sometimes and I'd say, "My God, some of the things that are going on in your life, I can't even imagine why you're having a good day." And yet he gave me the enthusiasm. It was like, you know, he could have all these problems, and when you get to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, he was lit up, man. And I'd say, "Hey, go work with a newcomer." And he'd go grab some guy and he said, "Man, you can make it. You can make it. I can make it. My sponsor made it." You know them kind of guys? You just want to punch them. But you love them because they're lit up. See, and this guy, man, he's the way he was. He just, and I got his first year, man. Got his first year, and I went and gave him a cake. Gee, money, man. His old man was sitting in that room, you know. And I sit there, man, and Scotty come up there, and he took that cake, and he said, "Man, I made it. Jesus, I made it. My sponsor helped me." I'm sitting back there, I'm like, "Yeah, man. I'm his sponsor." You know, you get that feeling like shit. Yeah. And man, his second year, he's trucking right along, man. So good things are happening. He got a better job, and he come along, and about 2.5 years sober, while he met and fell in love with a little Al-Anon. You know, one of Sue's babies. People accuse us of matchmaking back there. We just put a bunch of sick people in the same room, and they just kind of migrate towards each other. Scotty married this little Al-Anon man, and they lit it up. And she's full of life and enjoyment. And I, gee, my knee, man, these two, they got it. Hey, I could not believe. Could not believe how much in love they were with this program. To the point, you know, I judged it. I thought, you know, they're going to have some real problems. And they didn't. They moved in together, man. They didn't have no money. And he was making all these payments and stuff. And she had all this. She'd gone to penitentiary for a drunk. Sober. And they moved in this apartment. They're doing things together, see? And I watch him and Scotty calling him and say, "How am I doing? How am I doing?" And I say, "Hey, you're doing good, man. Really, I'm doing good. Yeah, you're doing good." I'd say that to him because when I said he's doing good, he believed he was doing good. I didn't want to say, "Hey, you dumb shit." "Hey, you're doing good." And he believed he was doing good. He believed everything about that. Give him his third year cake. Man, it stirred your cake. There wasn't no ego in that deal, man. I seen that guy and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was a God. Because that guy stayed sober 3 years. He had more enthusiasm in his life. Him and that little gal had, you know, got engaged. They were going to get married. They'd saved a little money and a whole nine yards. And I watched it, you know, I mean, he's just, you know, he's out there working, you know, he's working one of them guys that works and works hard all day long, comes in a meeting and he's still got his work clothes on and he's got sweaty and he gets in there and he wants to hug everybody, you know. I love everybody. I love alcohol. And I'm saying, man, I don't even understand that. One night a year ago, went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. What's that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I went over there. I had to go talk down at the Anaheim Club. I went by there and Scotty was out there in the parking lot and he was lit up. Put his arms around me and I hugged him and I said, you know, I just love you. I just love you because you're full of life. I quit trying to figure it out. I just love you because you're full of life. And he went in that meeting with that Alcoholics Anonymous that night and they had a good meeting in there. Him and all the guys laughed and yucked it up. And after the meeting, man, he went home and he told his girlfriend, his fiance, you know, that was the best meeting I ever had in my entire life. I loved it. Man, it was great to be with those guys. I laughed. And they went to bed. And they started having sex. And he died. Bam. Right in the saddle. What a way to go. He died. Over. Boom. And she called us up and 10 minutes from my house, I'm over there. Bam. Paramedics kept trying to bring him back. I told him, man, it's over. It's over. It's over. Because that's all he was supposed to have. That's all he was supposed to have. That much. That much. That much. That's why he loved it so much. That's why that 3 years was so precious to him. That's why every day he was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was punching and jabbing and saying it's the best deal, because he only had that much. Only had that much. And it taught me a great lesson. I don't know how much I got. I really don't. But I don't want to waste it sitting around being pissed off at people. I don't want to waste it sitting around daydreaming about things that I'm never going to be or never going to get to do. I want to be in the now, right now. I want to be right here. I want my head and my body to be in the same place because I don't want to miss it. I want to be right now. Because I want to be like Scotty. You know, I opened up that kid's billfold. Everything in his billfold was about you. There was no gold cards in there. There wasn't $1,000 in cash. It was about 20 bucks. There was a whole bunch of addresses and AA cards from people. And he played sober softball all the time and was the captain of the team and he had all that softball certificates for the fields in there. Everything about that guy was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, how many times I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I judged the speaker, I judged the people, I was pissed off at my sponsor, I didn't want to work the steps, I didn't believe in God, I didn't want to do these things. How many times I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I wondered, would it ever work for me? I go home and I have those doubts and I'm wondering, am I got a short fuse and a soft temper or am I got a hard temper and going crazy? And I say, you know, from that point to this, I've come to understand. God, I want to be like Scotty. Because he loved it all. God gave him 3 years of full enjoyment, full on enjoyment. He lived with unresolved problems. But he enjoyed every minute of it. He taught me the greatest lesson of all. I don't want to cheat myself out of this deal. I don't want to be a sad story. I want to be able to be out of here enjoying it. It doesn't make any difference if I'm Bloomington, Illinois, or I'm going to be in, you know, Vancouver, B.C. next Saturday night. I'm going to be in Des Moines, Iowa the next weekend. And I'm going to be in my home group on Monday night and a home group on Wednesday night and a home group on Thursday night. But where I'm at, I'm going to be me and I'm going to be there, man. And I'm going to be right there with them. Because I don't want to miss it. I never wanted to cheat myself out of this deal, man. I want it all. I want the whole damn thing. I don't want to feel like that kid did. He taught me the greatest lesson of all. It's yours. It's free for the taking. Don't cheat yourself out of it, man. Don't look for something that's not here. You can live rent-free in my heart, man, but you're not going to live rent-free in my head no more, baby, because there's too many people out there that love me. There's too many people out there that I want to learn to love and I want to put my arms around and say, hey, We can have a good time here together. Let the ones that hate, hate. Let the ones that resent, resent. Let the ones that want to be depressed, be depressed. But there's plenty of little Scotties around here, man. You just got to look for them. They're in your group. They're the guy that may not have much time left. Who in the hell knows why, but they're enjoying it, man. They got a lit candle. It's like a Roman candle everywhere they are. They may be crazy. That's not a requirement. The second step, we come to believe that God can restore us to sanity. He does not say how much and how long it's going to take. But we're on a journey. And enjoy it. You bet. Enjoy it. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about turning it off. It's about turning it on. It's about coming up out of the crap and enjoying life. About taking a chance. You don't have a chance if you don't take a chance. The steps are about getting it out of the way so you can enjoy the whole day, man. So you can get out there and walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. So you can hold your head up. You don't crawl before no one anymore, man. I don't have to beg for nothing. I got a set of principles and a way to live, and I don't do it perfect all the time. But I do it good enough that I feel good about me. And I got up early this morning. I'm a long ways from where I'm supposed to be, but I'm right on time. And I woke up this morning, and I've been out there with the best of them all day long. I've been with the tall ones, the short ones, and the rich ones, and the poor ones. From the second I got up to this heartbeat right now, I ain't seen nobody or thought of nobody I'd rather be than me. God, that's what I look for in every pill, fix, and drink. You know? I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and people said, I love you. And I thought, man, you don't know me. If I get what I deserve, you had better not be sitting next to me. And I stayed here long enough to be able to say, I love you all. And the reason I can say that is not because of what you are individually, or where you came from necessarily. But it's because of what I am when I'm with you. See, we come from all walks of life. We come all the places. God, if I ain't nothing else, I want to have the enthusiasm about this deal that Scotty had. Because he had a short time to enjoy it. And I don't know how long I got, man, but I want it all. I want to enjoy it. I want to feel good about me. I want to feel comfortable when I lay my head on the pillow tonight. And I want to feel at ease and at peace with myself. And I may have a crazy head every once in a while, but I've got a quiet heart today. And I can put my head on that pillow and I can lay there and I can look back over my day and I know that I did the best I could to do it the right way. I know that there's a right way to take care of a wrong and I've given it my best shot. I know that I love that lady and I know how to prove that I love her is because I haven't cheated on her in 17 years. See, what you do speaks so loud I can't get to hear a word you say. You hear people all over Alcoholics Anonymous. You hear people all over Alcoholics Anonymous coming about the principles of the program and I work them and everything's great. They don't have their wife with them. They don't have their family with them. They don't have any kids with them. They don't have any babies with them to validate it. I don't know whether they're lying to me or not. I'd like to drop by their house on Saturday afternoon and check it out. I'm fortunate. My wife's here with me. And I know I love her because of the way I act. See? I know that I love her and I know she loves me. And no matter where I go, there's people that saw me when I came in here and they know that I've changed. I'm not the same person that came here. And I had lived this life because you gave me a chance. You gave me an opportunity to get a little piece of life, to enjoy it. It's free for the taking. You gotta want it. You gotta want it more than anything else. But that ain't no big deal. You gotta lighten up and let yourself enjoy it. You gotta quit harboring them these resentments, man, and get out there and kick up your heels. Have a dance here tonight, man. Get out there and have a good time. Act stupid and plastic and all that crap. But what the hell, that's what it's all about. Enjoy it. Don't take much, just everything you got, but then hell, what the hell? I never did want anything that was easy anyway. And I came here and I got a little piece of life and you gave me, and that's all I ever wanted to be. All my life I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth, and I didn't know how to do that. Had all the costumes and all the tools and the toys to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. If you want to know who the meanest man on the face of the earth is, it's me. I'm him. You know who he is? Real simple. It's me, that little guy who lived down the street. Got a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat. I get up in the morning, go take a shower, put a clean set of threads on, go in there in the kitchen, put my arms around my wife and say, I love you, baby. walk across the room, don't have to kick the dog and the cat, don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off on the way to work, you know, don't have to piss nobody off on the freeway, get down there and set out that job and do my job every day. I got a place where I show up, I clock in and I do it, and I sit there and I do it, and I don't tell the boss how to run his business. And I get up and I get whistle blows and I go get my check on Friday and I go put it in the bank, and I come home in the afternoon and I take a nap. For a speed freak, to take a nap is a spiritual experience. And I come to a place like this and I can laugh and cry and kiss them goodbye. See, you can teach a parrot to talk this shit, but it don't make him an alcoholic. An alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. And if you see people around Alcoholics Anonymous talking this shit, but they ain't living it, stay away from them. Watch them. Look, see what they're doing at home. See how they treat their kids. See how they treat their family. See how they treat the newcomer. If they can do the things that in here in Alcoholics Anonymous that they were doing out there on the street and not get drunk, they ain't an alcoholic. You want to know who the alcoholics are? That's a drunk with a conscience. And if they feel bad about the things and having to make amends for the things they're doing and they're changing, then they're an alcoholic. And then talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you do that, you got a chance. If you got a chance, that's all you need. Because that's all I needed. That's all I've ever had. That's all I ever wanted. God bless. Thank you.